More free with their money, then.
Yevgenia's teeth show.
Funny, isn't it? How the real dirty bastards are always the ones who are soft about home and their mothers. Not that they give a flying fuck about anybody else's. I look at some of them and I'm thinking, your soul's been squeezed out. There's nothing left in it anymore. But I don't ask them anything. I don't want to know. I tell them Mum's here when I bring him back, so that keeps him in order a bit.
Anna looks carefully around the room. Your Mum's here.
There.
Yevgenia points to the bed where Anna's sitting.
Under those coats, up against the wall. She always creeps up close to that wall in her sleep. She sleeps most of the time now.
Is she ill?
No, she just wants to sleep.
Yevgenia is still holding both Anna's hands.
Things have been hard for her, you see.
A flash of understanding passes between them. Anna moistens her lips. Your little boy?
Yeah. He had enough to eat, wasn't that? It was his cough. It went down on his chest. I paid the doctor to come here, but he didn't have anything to give him. Mum sat up holding him for 3 nights.
I had a kid, but my mum looks after him, and now he thinks my mum's his mum, if you see what I mean. So I don't interfere. What was his name?
Goria. He had a proper burial, I made sure of that. I didn't dump him at the cemetery gates. Mum couldn't come because of her legs, so it was just him and me. I paid a bottle of vodka for them to dig the grave, and I stood over them and made sure they did it right. He was all wrapped up warm. I took him there on the sledge. But it was a long time to wait while they dug, because the frost had gone so deep into the ground. But I wasn't going to go until I'd seen him safely buried. I picked him up and held him. It was just him and me then.
When all this is over, you'll set a gravestone for him.
Yeah. You know, Anna, the worst bit is I keep thinking that when all this is over, it'll go back to how it was. The dead aren't really dead forever, only for the duration, if you get what I mean. Like when a kid's playing hide-and-seek and they hide for ages, dead still until you shout, "It's all right, you can come out now." And they do come out. I think like that, even though I saw him buried. And then I start going crazy and thinking maybe it wasn't him. Maybe I only thought it was me standing there holding him. But I don't feel it properly. I think Gory is dead, and that seems normal, but not true at the same time, if you see what I mean. And then I think, what if I start feeling it? You know, when things are different, when all this is over.
Anna turns Yevgenia's hands over and strokes the palms. We can't think about it.
You've warmed up a bit anyway.
Yes. I must go soon. They'll be frightened about me at home.
It's nice, though, just sitting here talking. I never have time.
You sit here for a bit while I make the tea. The room swims in warmth. I'll rest just for a minute while she makes the tea. Imagine a stove with a pile of wood in the corner. And they're eating, you can tell that. But snow has got into the room somehow. It dances in front of her, and out of it comes a figure, man or woman, walking towards her. The sledge squeaks.
Here, don't drop it.
Yevgenia places the glass of hot tea in Anna's hand. Its fragrance wreathes around her face. She sips. It's real tea, hot and strong. And there's sugar in it.
One of my clients gave me half a cup of sugar. Well, if someone gets so drunk he can't see, then he's going to lose stuff, isn't he? I've still got Mum to look after.
There's a note in her voice Anna's never heard before. Harsh, defiant, but shamed. It's these times, says Anna. There I was earlier on, crawling round on the floor of a burned-out apartment building, digging up half-burnt blocks of wood. This woman wanted to borrow my chisel, and I didn't let her. But it's not just that. I'd have stuck the chisel into her if she'd tried to grab it.
You find yourself doing things you'd never have thought you could do. That's it. You know you're changing, but you still think you can find the way back to what you used to be. And then one day you know you can't. You've gone through a drunk's pockets and stolen his stuff and then tipped him out of the door into the snow. And not cared if he froze to death. Well, so how are things with you?
My father hasn't got long now. With the rest of us, it's only hunger, the same as everyone.
I can let you have some wood,
but you need it yourself.
Well, I can get more. As long as I've got my clients, we're better off than you are. And everyone knows me. Besides, they don't want to come back here and get frostbite in their wedding tackle, so I usually get to hear of it if there's a wooden house being torn down.
Wedding tackle? Is that what they call it?
They don't sound the marrying kind. It's the same as the way they all have a thing about their mums. They all like talking nice when they get a chance. Shut up about it now, Anna. Mum's awake.
The coats stir as if an animal is digging itself out of hibernation. Two small, sharp eyes regard Anna.
Who's this, then, Evgenia?
This is Anna, a friend of mine.
Evgenia's mother pushes off the coverings and painfully edges her scrawny body off the bed.
I had such a sleep.
I know you did, Mum. You've been asleep for hours.
I kept hoping I'd dream, but I didn't dream. Is it morning yet?
It's evening, Mum. It's not late.
The old woman hobbles over to the far, shadowy side of the room. She lights a second candle, and Anna sees the embroidered cloth, the little lamp, the icon, the small photograph of a child.
When are you going to get oil for my lamp, Genya? My beautiful corner's not right without it.
When I can, Mum. You know there's no oil in the market now, and we've got to keep what's left for the big lamp. You've got your candle.
The old woman heaves herself to her knees in front of the icon and crosses herself repeatedly.
She's a believer. You can't change that, says Evgenia quietly. That last campaign against backwardness we had, they called us in one by one at the factory and asked if our children were baptised, and if there are any icons in the house. So what could I do? I had to lie. I didn't baptise Goria, but Mum crept off somewhere and got him done, just like I knew she would.
Slowly, tremblingly, the old woman leans forward until her lips touch the painted feet of the infant Christ in his mother's arm. I must go now.
I'll walk with you as far as the cathedral. Then you'll be all right.
Evgenia bundles wood into a hemp bag. Well, not as much as that, Evgenia.
Kids can't keep themselves warm like we can.
Take the rest of this sugar for your collier.
Anna watches as Evgenia pours the remaining sugar carefully into a cone of newspaper and twists the top. Evgenia, what about your mother? She'll want that.
Look at her.
The old woman is still keeled forward, whispering.
You know what she's saying?
Evgenia, don't. She'll hear you.
She won't. She's deaf.
She's giving them her instructions about Goria.
Mind he keeps his jacket buttoned up. And he doesn't like parsnips, so please, merciful Virgin, give him carrots instead. And then at bedtime he has to have his cod liver oil, and he sometimes tries to spit it out, so, my dear one, make sure you watch him till he swallows it.
It's as much as I can stand to listen to her sometimes. They're a lot more real to her than I am. It's them she wants to be with. I put good food in front of her, and she just stares at it, as if she doesn't know what it is. Then she goes back to bed and sleeps, like you saw. Because she doesn't want to live any more. She wants to be with them. But I don't. And I don't know if that's right or wrong. I do want to live. I don't care how bad it is, I still want to live.
I know.
I knew as soon as I met you that you were like that too. You can tell straight away. Some people don't have it in them. And they just fade away. I could have looked at you and Katya out there and known straight away who that wall was going to fall on. It's not even something we want. It's the way we are. We just have to keep on. Often, I think it'd be easier to be like Mum now.
only I can't be. So everything I do now, I'm going to have to live with for the rest of my life.
I don't see how you can be sure, says Anna. But even as she says it, she knows that Yevgenia is right.
One look at Yevgenia's tough, strong-boned face, and death would back off to find an easier target.
God knows there are plenty.
Mum says these are the latter days, says Yevgenia.
What does she mean?
Well, she's got a little book of prophecies. It says that in the latter days two giant serpents shall do battle until they devour the world with fire and thunder.
I can't think who those two serpents could be.
Me neither. I keep telling her it's a load of cobblers.
But Yevgenia's sharp, ironic eyes are gleaming.
Still, wouldn't be a bad bargain if we got rid of two serpents for the price of one, would it?
But they'd have already devoured the world.
Yeah, there is that.
But still, in the latter days, in the time of blood, Yevgenia quotes. That's what her book says.
They go to the door.
She'll be there for hours,
whispers Yevgenia, glancing back at her mother. It's hard for you.
I wish she'd just talk to me.
A doctor I know says it's hunger that's making everyone so strange. It's nothing personal.
She's not hungry. I'll make sure of that. But what's the point of me doing all this if she won't eat?
Yevgenia.
It's all right. I'm just being stupid.
They're in each other's arms. They're rocking each other. It's all right. It'll all be over soon. It'll get better. Have a good cry. For a long time they cling. 5 minutes. Maybe 10. The minutes belong only to them.
Then Yevgenia draws away, wiping her cheeks. We'd better get going. I'll see you on your way.
I'll be fine.
I know. As long as you don't...
waste.
Bloody.
Was it bloody, she said? Or fucking?
Bloody.
Sausage, they say, both together, their faces only inches apart. In the latter days, in the time of blood... But here there's no blood. Snow lies congealed on the roofs, and blood congeals in the bodies that loll in frozen parks. Not a drop spills all through the long night. This is Peter's city, built on the marshes of the Baltic. Labourers brought soil to build it on, carrying soil in the hems of their cloaks. They laid down their bones, and the city walked over them. They sank down.
When there were enough of them, Peter had his foundations.
Late in the morning, a lilac-coloured dawn will come, with burning frost that glitters on branches, on spills of frozen water, on snow, cupolas, and boarded-up statues. Nothing has ever been more beautiful than these broad avenues, the snow-coloured Neva, the parks and embankments. Only the people mar its perfection as they crawl out of their homes into the radiance of snow. Perhaps today is the day when they'll fail to reach the bread queue. So they move on, flies caught between sheets of glass. Chapter 27.
The December death toll is mounting. The figures can't be accurate because not all the dead find their way to cemeteries or to common graves dynamited out of frozen earth. It's impossible to count those who lie frozen in their homes or covered in snow on their way to a destination nobody remembers. Pavlov sees them, as everyone else sees them. A foot sticking out of a snowdrift here, a bundle face down on the Neva ice. Those dead don't go away. They aren't buried, and they won't decay. There will be a major public health crisis once spring comes, thinks Pavlov automatically. Then he turns his mind away. That is not his problem.
Pavlov's problem is the next day, and the one after. His job is to inch Leningrad towards life. His job is life, although he understands that there must be death, and sometimes there is so much of it that it seems to come off on his hands, like newsprint.
On available statistics, the deaths for December look as if they'll be 4 or 5 times November's figures. We're coming up to 40,000. Are you sure? Have those figures been checked and confirmed? Raps out Pavlov. I need an accurate picture. He's got to know how many ration cards will not be re-registered at the beginning of next month. Now that everyone has to appear in person to re-register his or her card each month, the dead can't distort the system with their ghost rations. It makes fraud more difficult, although still not difficult enough. Fraud, black market, and theft are distorting his statistics. Pavlov rubs his eyes. The penalty for any misappropriation of food must be summary. That is no problem. That is already happening. Black marketeers, thieves, and ration card forgers can expect no mercy. Those who manipulate the system from within are the worst, and must be punished most harshly and publicly, so that examples are made. The problem is that when so many are dying, the death penalty loses its edge. So much flour, so much sugar, so much fat. High-protein airlifts are coming in, but quantities are pitiful. 50 or 60 tons of high-calorie food a day against a target of 200 tons. Sometimes the planes are grounded and nothing arrives. But whatever the military airlift brings, it won't fill those millions of mouths. The ice road over Lake Ladoga is what's going to save the city, if anything will. But progress on that front is still slow. So many trucks have gone through the ice, or broken down, and those that are left take nearly 3 times the projected journey time. Blizzards often make it close to impossible for trucks to navigate from one station on the ice to the next, and when the skies clear, the German bombers come. It's a heroic struggle. Of course it is. Everything's heroic. You can take that for granted. But it's not the point. Pavlov's pen rests on his paper. He looks up, calculating. His eyes are reddened with smoke and lack of sleep, but he's a strong man, and he knows how far he can drive himself. The Kirov works have just had to stop production, although the workers are still there, heroically defending the factory, sleeping in shifts, staying at their posts even when they can't stand up, but producing nothing. We don't need any more heroes. We need tanks. We need anti-aircraft batteries and engineers with spare parts. Even when supplies have got safely over the ice, there's the nightmare of the single-track line from Lake Ladoga to Leningrad. Railway staff are starving, like everyone else. They can't keep the line clear, and it needs constant repair after regular bombing raids. There's not enough fuel for the engines, there's a shortage of skilled manpower, and they can't even get together enough up-to-strength gangs to clear the lines and points. Here are the latest figures. More figures on thin paper in front of him. Hungrily, his mind seizes on the statistics. That's Pavlov's gift. Figures don't overwhelm him. They sharpen him. At once, the new figures slot into their place in the latest of the plans he's had to make on the wing 50 times this winter. He knows they call him the food czar behind his back, but he takes it as a compliment. Besides, he doesn't underestimate his enemy. Pavlov knows his Nekrasov. The greatest czar of all is hunger. Nekrasov got it right about that. But it's no good cowering before hunger. No, you've got to keep your head and attack before it's too late. Get that Irinovsky line going, no matter what it takes. Get the ice road up to full production the way it should be. Never mind if those bastards bomb the railway night and day. Get the gangs onto the line and repair it every time. If those in charge can't organise, shoot them. Of course there'll be losses. So do it now, before the deaths rise any more. Corpses can't clear railway lines or man the stations on the ice. He knows that military command is with him on this. He's talked to Zhdanov. Those on the lowest ration level can't live for long, unless they have private stores of hoarded food. It's unlikely that they'll have such stores. After almost 3 months of mounting hunger, any more than they'll have fat left on their bodies. The fat is all burned off. The cupboards are stripped. These people now receive 2 slices of adulterated bread each day. Because their body fat has gone, their muscle is being consumed by the engine of their bodies. They drop dead from hypothermia, heart failure, exhaustion, and all those diseases that have a thousand names but come to the same thing. Starvation.
Deaths reported from dystrophy and other starvation-related diseases, drones a voice behind him.
Kindly don't waste my time giving me that information again, snaps Pavlov. I am familiar with the pathology. I want precise figures for the amount of flour in storage at the West Ladoga warehouses. It is essential that all possible efforts are made to increase the volume of supplies brought in over the ice road.
Like body fat, the number of those into whose mouths he must put food is melting.
30,000 deaths, you say? 40? 45?
The numbers are written in columns. In other columns, the tonnage of flour, fat, sugar, meat is noted just as meticulously. When he cut the ration at the end of November, a raw stenographer blurted out, "But the people will die!" and then went white, realizing what she had said. There was no one else in the room. If there had been, he would have had to take action.
"Do you think I have no human feeling?" asked Pavlov quickly.
"No, of course not. I didn't intend..."
"I take responsibility. Do you understand that?"
"Yes." She doesn't understand. And she can't understand. To be the one who writes the order is not pleasant, even when you know it's the only thing to be done. He's writing history. But at the same time, history is writing him. He hasn't got the choice that girl thinks he has. And back in Moscow, the boss is watching him. But things will change. They have got to. Pavlov can sense a change which can't yet be seen, or heard, or felt. It's like a certain rawness in the air after months of dry frost. Hundreds of kilometres to the south, there's a warm wind stirring, although the frozen river doesn't know this yet. These are not things you can know or understand, but you sense them and your blood stirs with them. No, it's true. These really are the greatest pleasures of all, those pleasures you don't really understand. Pavlov has leaned forward. His hands grip the desk. He is not in grey, winter-haunted Leningrad now, but in a village 80 miles southwest of Moscow, standing on a shallow cliff above a river where the ice is breaking. Thick sheets of ice bump and grind against one another. Some are forced underwater by the pressure of the current racing over them. The air's full of the noise of water, rushing and urgent, and all at once he realizes how long and silent the winter has been. A bird flies low over the surface of the river, skims it, and then rises over the wooded opposite bank. There's a smell of mud and raw, churning water, and surely the light over those folded hills is clearer now. It picks out their curves like a promise.
So many tons at West Ladoga. So many tons stored in Leningrad. So many on their way to Leningrad across the ice road. It's the third week in December, the coldest and darkest week of all, when the pulse of life sinks lowest.
It's not dramatic to die of hunger. No one has the strength to run into the streets, bleeding and cursing. This is an invisible disaster, like the death of a hive in winter. But when it's spring and the hive's opened, it will all become clear. Like cells, the apartment houses of Leningrad will be packed with bodies, shriveled and blackened with frost. Pavlov pulls another piece of paper towards him. On it he sketches a graph, plotting the rise in the death rate against the cuts he has made in rations. He arrives at mid-December, pauses, then continues, extrapolating into the January that has not yet arrived. Assume no rise in the ration. Assume that the death rate follows the December pattern. No further cuts, but no rise. Dependents remain on 125 grams of bread per day. On through January, into February. The angle of his graph points at the sky, carrying the lives of more than half the population of Leningrad with it. It goes on up. They die faster. He looks again at his up-to-date lists of reserve food supplies. His reserves are pitiful.
All they guarantee is a few more days' bare survival. If he increases the ration by as much as 20 grams, the risk is appalling. But leave it like this, and the citizens of Leningrad will die anyway. There's only one thing that gives him any room for manoeuvre, and that's the potential of the ice road. Not what it's done for Leningrad so far, certainly, but what it might do. He lifts the telephone, pulling graph and statistics in front of him, and makes a call to Zhdanov and the Leningrad military command. Hours later, Pavlov picks up his graph of the projected Leningrad death rate and scrutinizes it again. Then he strikes a match, holds a corner of the paper to it, and lets it burn. He doesn't need it, because the figures are printed on his mind. And besides, it's a document that doesn't need to be seen by anyone, especially by that stenographer with the white face, who said, "But people will die!" Blackness scrolls up the side of the paper. Only when the flame is about to touch his fingers does he blow it out and crush the burnt paper to ash. On the 25th of December, the daily bread ration will be increased by 100 grams for workers and 75 grams for dependents. But the stenographer was perfectly right. In another part of Leningrad, on Vasilyevsky Island, 3 days later, a child opens her notebook. It's a small notebook, made to fit in a pocket, like an address book. The letters of the alphabet run down the right-hand side. In the clear handwriting of a well-taught 11-year-old, she writes her first entry. Zhena. She goes back and underlines the word. Zhena. She died on the 28th of December at 12:30 in the morning, 1941. In future entries, she will not underline the names. She will record the deaths of her family, one by one, until they are all there. At the end, she'll write, "The Savitchevi are dead. They are all dead. Only Tanya is still here." Pavlov, too, is perfectly correct. He's writing history, while history writes him. He rubs his eyes. His colleague watches from across the room. Pavlov frightens him, but it's not fear he feels at this moment, but something else, closer to pity. Chapter 28. It is 10 past midnight. Darkness, stillness, cold. A savage cold that is strong enough to halt the beat of blood, strong enough to turn the dead into logs of frost. All four of them huddle together, sharing their body heat. They're fully dressed, down to hats with ear flaps, gloves and scarves. At the foot of the mattresses, four pairs of boots stand ready. The ventilation window has been mended with layers of cardboard where a shell burst shattered it 2 weeks ago. The other windows are crusted with frost, inside and outside. Outside, an ice-laden wind sifts the snow into whirling demons at empty street corners. But it's dark. Dark. Nothing of this can be seen. There's only the savagery of cold, like an animal prowling the room, lashing every inch of exposed skin. Outside, the midnight temperature is 18 degrees below zero. It has been dark since 3 o'clock, and it will be dark late into the morning. Long, long hours when there's nothing to do but cling together and keep alive. If she touched the buzhuika now, its freezing metal would stick to her palm. Tomorrow they'll burn more books. Thank God there are books to burn. He doesn't see the burning of his books. Four people lie together in one room, but in the next he's alone. He lies on his back, his nose jutting into the cold. His hands are folded on his breast, and they hold a book. His skin is glazed solid. The cold can rage around him as much as it likes, but it can't do him any harm. He's part of it now. It has cauterized his wounds. There's no smell of sickness anymore, and although death has come into the room, it too remains frozen, dormant, like a winter visitor who will only come to life with the spring.
Are you asleep?
No. Are you?
No.
How's the little one?
Sleeping.
You're sure?
Yes, sure. But his feet are cold.
Give me your hand.
In their cave of rugs and blankets, two hands meet. There is no warmth in the touch. Two hands, stiff, chill, claw-like, fold into one another. They are not male or female any more. But they are alive. One hand stretched out to another, touching. From the child there is a sudden spasmodic explosion of coughing. His body shakes, his chest rattles, but he doesn't wake. Andrei and Anna press closer, one on each side of Kolya's body, warming it as much as they can.
Marina's sleeping.
Yes, says Anna. She's sleeping. It's only sleep.
Kolya shakes and coughs. Anna undoes her coat and pulls him inside. Slowly, with stiff fingers, she buttons her coat back over them both. He burrows into her, choking against the skin of her neck. She rubs his back and tucks his feet between her hollow thighs. The four of them, musty, in clothes that they don't take off at night. Four pairs of boots stand by the mattresses, and when they crawl from their cave of blankets into the freezing room, all they have to do is step into them. But everything takes so long. It hurts to breathe. You get palpitations. Marina is curled into a ball at Anna's back, turned away from the others, her fist pressed into the hollow under her cheekbone. Imagine being asleep and dreaming. Dreams of food. Dreams of fragrant, smoking hot soup made with dried mushrooms. Tiny dumplings float on top of it, golden and puffy. Kolya's honey. The glass jar is almost empty. Only one spoonful left. Things will get better. They've got to. The blockade will be lifted. Our forces will take back Umgar, and the Moscow Railway will reopen. The circle of siege will break. Only Kolya's honey stretches between this time, now, and then, when things will be better. A thin, dark, sweet thread smelling of heather and smoke. One spoonful. They'll all watch while Anna lifts the spoon to Kolya's mouth. There. Slowly. Don't gobble it. In go the precious calories and vitamins. Is it their imagination, or is there a little more colour in Kolya's wasted cheeks as he swallows? Anna reaches out, catches on her finger a drop which has fallen from the spoon onto the side of the glass jar, and puts her finger into the child's mouth to suck. He sucks, and keeps on sucking long after the sweetness has gone. On these threads they hang. The honey jar is here, wedged against the mattress. If thieves broke in, they wouldn't find it. Anna fingers it. The pain in her stomach sharpens. She snatches her hand back into the cave of blankets. The cold, dead rooms of the apartment lean over her. Each frozen cell hangs suspended in the comb of the apartment building. Below, there are the icy, ringing staircases, the courtyard shrouded in snow, the unswept pavements, the shell-damaged buildings, the bomb sites, the inner-city defences she helped to construct back in September, in another life. Beyond them, the iron ring of the invading army pressing on Leningrad's neck. There is Leningrad, paralysed like her own flesh and blood. Kolya is sucking in his sleep. His lips move against her neck, rooting for food, like the baby he was 5 years ago. Andrei is silent. He's asleep again, like Marina. His hand has fallen away from hers. These are the most difficult hours. The hours after midnight, when day is still unimaginably far off. Anna drowses, jerks suddenly out of sleep, then drowses again. Her stomach hurts. She draws up her knees, cradling Kolya. Her toes are itching, but she can't reach them. It sounds as if death is walking about in the next room. Its footsteps are clear and close. Tomorrow, the fight for food, for warmth, for one more day's survival. Tomorrow, once again, they won't take her father's body to the cemetery.
If Kolya's little sledge hadn't been stolen, they might have managed it. Her father will have to stay here, and it's been 6 days now. Or is it seven? Time slipping, like the mat of blankets. She begins to count back. It was on the Thursday. No, the day before. Tomorrow the honey will be gone. Don't think of it now. Kolya's heart ticks against her breastbone. Do children's hearts normally beat as fast as this? He whimpers, but doesn't cough. That's right, sleep. Sleep. They can't blockade your sleep. The night passes. Then it's night again. 9 days now since her father's death. Or is it 10? It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The sun comes out, and its light pushes through crisscrossed paper into the room where Anna's father lies. The room grows radiant. Shadows of frost leaf and frost petal settle on the mound of Mikhail's body. His beard sparkles, but he sleeps on in frigid silence, as he has slept for 10 days now. Or is it 9? Now the sunlight vanishes as the sky grows yellow with coming snow. The bakery is opened late again. Today it was because a shortage of water delayed the baking of bread. When Anna got back with the rations, Andrei was already home from the hospital after a night shift. He ought to sleep there all the time, like the other doctors, but he still insists on coming home whenever he can. He got a lift on a truck this time, he tells her. It's crazy to use up his energy like that, but she's given up arguing about it. She only argued from duty. She wants him here. Andrei is asleep, with Kolya in his arms, when Anna comes in. She stoops to check Kolya's breathing. His face is peaceful, locked in sleep. His cough's getting better now. This is his best and deepest sleep, the midday sleep after the midday meal of bread soup. He'll have had a couple of spoonfuls of buckwheat porridge today as well. They've got into a system of eating half their rations as late in the evening as they can, and the other half at noon. That way, it doesn't matter how late Anna gets back with the bread. They've at least got something to eat at noon. And if one day the bakery doesn't open at all, or something happened to Anna, they could keep going until the following day. They would never have to say to Kolya, "There's nothing to eat today." 17 hours to endure, between 7 in the evening and noon the next day. This morning, Anna rinsed the empty honey jar with hot water for Kolya. The rest of them had hot water flavoured with nettle tea that Anna dries after use and then reuses. She puts a pinch of salt in the tea. Salt stops you feeling dizzy. If only her father hadn't died so close to the end of the month. They were only able to claim his ration for a few days after he died. Then it was re-registration time. Everyone must re-register in person. If someone dies at the beginning of the month, just after registration, you do well. As much as 30 days of extra rations. As it was, Anna dried a half slice of the extra bread from her father's ration over the buzhuika each day and put it away. The 7 half slices are hidden in a vase with a heavy plate over it. She checks them every morning to make sure mice haven't got at them, although there don't seem to be mice around anymore. Cats, crows, dogs and pigeons have all been eaten. People are eating rats. And rats are eating people in apartments where the dead lie on the floor in puddles of ice. Perhaps someone in their apartment building has trapped and eaten the mice. Or more likely, the mice know that there's no living for them here, not even a crumb. They've broken the blockade and gone to the German lines. She lifts the plate. There is the dried bread, untouched. If the rations cut again, or Kolya gets another illness, at least she's got something in reserve. Or if he cries too much. Now that he's getting over his illness, he cries more.
"Anna," he said one day, "when are you going to make my soup?"
"What soup, Kolyinka?"
"You always make me soup when I've been ill, to build me up again."
He looked at her reproachfully, like an old man. He remembered the chicken soup she used to make after anyone had been ill, flavoured with parsley and a handful of dried chanterelles. It was golden, flecked with green, with the faintest pearling of chicken fat on its surface. If she had the flour, she would make wheat dumplings as well, feather-light and floating. Kolya used to love it when he was allowed to lower the dumplings one by one on their slotted spoon and watch them sink to the bottom of the pan before they swelled and rose to the surface. The dumplings absorbed any excess fat, so that the soup's texture was perfect. Kolya was still talking.
"You know, Anna, your chicken soup. I like that soup."
Anna swallowed the gush of saliva in her mouth. "I'll make you some soup." She made him bread soup, crumbling a half slice in water and heating it over the stove with a pinch of salt. He drank it greedily, like a convict clutching the cup to him. Yes, Kolya's getting better, but he's so weak they don't let him out of the one room they can keep above freezing. The pipes in the bathroom are frozen anyway, so he doesn't need to go in there. The toilet's frozen too. They use an old chamber pot, which Anna empties into a snowdrift in the yard. Sometimes she hasn't got the strength to carry it downstairs, and then she puts the pot out on the landing, its sullen stew of urine and feces covered by a tin plate. It's so cold that soon the chamber pot freezes too, and the next time she goes down to the yard she has to hack out the frozen sludge before she can throw it away. Everything takes so long. Every day she is slower. Her hands are stiff, joints swollen, fingers raw. She cut the web of skin between thumb and finger on her left hand when she was chopping wood, and it won't heal. Oh, she's never been clumsy like that before. Yevgenia's wood is all gone, but Andrei got another sackful when the wooden fence around the hospital was torn down, and there are still books to burn. Her father's Shakespeare is on the shelf above his bed. Anna draws the quilt up around the back of Andrei's head. But where's Marina? The bourgeoisie is almost out. Anna opens the stove, where the fire is down to red ash. Kneeling, she teases it with scraps of paper and splinters of wood until flames lick up out of the ash. She makes a little wigwam of kindling and then adds two larger chunks of fencing. Even in here, with the stove going, the windows are blank with frost. Yesterday, the temperature outside fell to 20 degrees below zero. The radio says that newspaper pads should be used to wrap children's chests. Newspaper, because of its insulating properties, provides excellent protection. If you have no newspaper, you can take a book apart and stitch layers of pages into a child's vest. You might think it was better to burn the book as fuel, but in the fight against cold, you need long-term weapons as well as short-term ones. A paediatrician gave details of how she had stitched together layers of Tolstoy into a vest for her 6-year-old son. The door to the kitchen is closed. Marina? But no one answers. Perhaps she's gone down for water. But what if she can't carry it back the way she couldn't last time? What if Anna's got to haul the water upstairs and support Marina as well? It's bad enough to make no scent alone with a bucket of water. She has to grope her way upwards because the lights don't work, stopping every few steps, terrified of slipping on a patch of ice left where someone else spilled their water. Tears of anger and weakness spring to Anna's eyes.
Marina! I'm here,
answers Marina from behind the closed door of Anna's father's room. Anna hasn't been in there since he was laid to rest. She pushes the door, and it opens easily, sending out a coil of freezing air. Quickly she steps inside and shuts the door behind her, so Kolya won't be chilled. There's a light fur of frost on her father's face. He lies on his back, with a book between his hands. It's a battered volume of Pushkin, folded there by Marina before Mikhail's body stiffened. Marina, wrapped in coat and shawl, sits beside the bed. The shawl is wound around her face so that only her eyes show as she turns to the door. But her hands are bare, and they are wrapped around Mikhail's.
But Marina, your hands! You'll get frostbite. You mustn't stay in here.
She lifts Marina's hands. They are stiff, marbled blue and red. Anna rubs them between her own, as Yevgenia did. Marina's hands feel dead between hers.
"It's all right," says Marina. "I've only just taken off my gloves. I wanted to touch him."
Anna continues to rub for a while, then fumbles Marina's fingers back into their gloves. Marina doesn't help her. She seems not to understand why Anna is moving her hands about.
"We can't stay in here. You could freeze to death."
"It's all right. You go in the other room. It's just that I wanted to be with him for a while," Marina explains, as if everything is perfectly normal.
It's normal for a dead man to stay in the next room until he's covered with a pall of frost. It's the same in rooms all over Leningrad. Anna knows that because she's talked to other women in the queues.
"I'm alone now, but he's still with me. I've made a corner for him."
In some rooms, whole families lie and wait for spring. They can't bury her father yet. The ground's too hard. Crowds of bodies are piled at the cemetery gates, waiting. And even if there were graves, their combined strength wouldn't get her father down all those stairs. "And there's no sledge," she finds herself explaining to him. "And so we've got to keep you here. We can't help it."
He has drawn her close to him too. She's right by the bedside now.
There's the Shakespeare on the shelf above her father's head. 7 volumes, with their red leather covers and thick, creamy sheets of paper. Marina sees her glance and says,
"But it was his Pushkin he wanted."
"Did he tell you that?"
Marina pulls her shawl down so her mouth is uncovered.
"No, but I knew."
Her pallid, drawn face lightens.
"Do you remember what happens after the duel? Onegin rushes to the youth, peers at him, calls his name. Useless. He's gone. And how Zaryetsky puts Lenski into the sleigh, cold and dead. You remember that?
And so it's all happening again, exactly as Pushkin said. It happened to Pushkin, and it's happening to your father. The snow, and the sledges, and the dead man.
Did you ever hear your father read that passage?"
"I don't remember it."
"But he was always reading Pushkin."
"Of course. I remember him reading it aloud one evening." "Oh, no, he wasn't reading, he was reciting it. He had the book in front of him, but he knew it by heart. His eyes were closed. He didn't need the book, but I think he liked the feel of it in his hands."
"Yes, I remember. He used to say his memory was going, and that's why he always had the book."
Her father in his chair, perfectly upright, face raised up a little, eyes shut, mouth faintly smiling. He would begin to recite, and she would listen for a while, and then become bored. Perhaps not bored exactly, but restless. She'd want to be elsewhere. And then Kolya would clatter in, wanting something to eat, and she'd have an excuse to get away. All those pieces of paper he was always writing on. What was going to become of them? She tried to read his stories, but she'd never enjoyed them. Everything in them had to be explained to her.
"Don't think of that now."
"He didn't recite like an actor so that you became aware of him and his personality," said Marina. "He had too much respect for the life of the poem." "Marina, you must come out of here. Could you draw him for me now, Anna?"
"What? As he is?"
"Yes."
"I can't."
"He'll be forgotten.
All of it will be forgotten, and they'll say it never happened."
"You've got to stay alive yourself if you don't want things to be forgotten."
"Get your paper, Anna. Please, just a quick sketch. We've got to have a record."
"My paper's finished."
"You could draw in one of his books." "The Shakespeare. That's got wide margins. And the end papers are good."
Stiffly, Marina stretches up and lifts down the book.
"Look, I've even got a pencil. Draw him. Please. Otherwise it will all disappear."
"You promise you'll come out of here and sit by the stove when I've done it?"
"I promise."
Anna draws badly, with gloved hands. She's not going to risk frostbite for this. And she's angry with Marina for making her look at what she doesn't want to see. The trouble with drawing is that you have to look, if it's going to be any good.
Her father, who is now iron flesh on an iron bed. His head is uncovered, and there's ice in his hair. She draws the wasted lines of cheek and jaw, the jut of his nose, and the bony hollows of his temples. She draws carefully, as if she loves what's lying there. But she doesn't. He's gone, and Marina suffered for nothing when she touched him with her bare hands like that. He's somewhere else, not thinking about them at all. But Marina... No, Marina doesn't understand that. She believes that they are together, her and Misha, as she always calls him now. She's not afraid of him. She leans forward to watch the lines as they sprout from Anna's pencil. "That's him," she murmurs. "You're right. Do it like that." The sketch is done. Anna hands the book to Marina, averting her face from her father. "You promised you'd come away now."
"Yes, I will." "You don't understand how important this is, Anna. I can see that you don't like it. But that's because you don't understand, not because I'm wrong. Your father was a great man. And suddenly everything changes." Anna turns and looks at her father, but this time without anger. He's gone. He's where he wants to be. And he's a lump of frozen meat, but also he's magnificent, with a book between his hands and his nose jutting at the ceiling. He is what he is. He hasn't changed. "Maybe he was born to bring a blessing, or even great things to this world. His silenced lyre might have sent music echoing through times to come like thunder. For this poet may be, on the ladder of the ages, a high rung waited. Maybe his martyr's spirit carried away with it a holy secret," goes on Marina. "Surely you remember, Anna, how your father used to recite that passage?"
"Yes, yes, I think so," answers Anna. And this time she really thinks she does remember. And now it doesn't matter that Marina's wrong, that her father's stories are dull and hard to understand, and that even if they keep all those pieces of paper, nobody will want to read them. He wasn't a great man. But that's of no importance at all. She does remember. At the dacha, under the honeysuckle, her father with his book, a heavy cloud of the Sokolov's bees booming in the blossom, and then the words spilling quietly out from the shade where he sat, to the veranda where Anna stirred her cloudberry jam over the stove. Her father, upright, preoccupied, and slightly absurd, turns and gives her his rare, sweet smile.
"How's that jam getting on?" "It smells wonderful. Cloudberries always make the best jam of all."
Was that what he said? Something, anyway, that made her wave the wooden spoon at him in greeting so that little drops of cloudberry jam spattered her blue cotton dress. "Yes, I remember," she says. Marina nods, satisfied. Chapter 29. Marina is so cold she's barely able to reach the stove. She hobbles across the room, leaning on Anna. Shudders run through her and into Anna.
"Here, sit down."
Anna speaks gently, although she wants to shake Marina off and push her into the chair. But Marina continues to stand stiffly. The cold has got into her, as Anna knew it would. She's been holding hands with the dead, and you mustn't do that. You must let go straight away, as soon as they touch you. Anna presses her down into the chair.
"Stay there. Warm yourself," she says.
But she can't leave Marina. They are trapped together in their dark wood. There the trees grow so thickly that rain and sun don't spill through. There's a bed of brown needles and sometimes the skeleton of a bird that has hidden itself away to die. Anna stares around for rescue.
and there is the heap of Kolya and Andrei, sleeping. She can only see the back of their heads, in their fur caps. Kolya always wears his fur cap now without any arguments, because Andrei wears one.
At home, hunters always sleep in their clothes like this. They make a shelter out of pine bark, and they plaster it with snow, and then they're quite warm.
Snow is an insulator, you see, Kolya.
Is it? Can we make one of those shelters?
Yes, why not? When it's safe to go out in the forest again.
You and me and Anna.
The birds will come back. There'll be orioles in the woods again, and corncrakes where the meadow flows into the stream down by the Sokolov farmhouse. There'll be the upheaval of spring again. Tumult of birds drilling out song in the wet branches. There'll be ice breaking on the Neva, sparks of green on black earth, morning light as sharp as lemons, and a rush of brown froth where snow water melts. It will all come back again. I believe in it, says Anna to herself, folding her hands around Marina's knuckles.
What a beautiful colour, says Marina.
She's looking intently at the scrap of Turkish rug under her feet. It's almost threadbare, but it's been an article of faith all Anna's life that it's valuable, you know. Handmade. You can't get rugs like it now. The colour is dark, subtle crimson shading into deep brown.
Really beautiful.
It's worn out, says Anna.
But I'm glad you use it. You should use beautiful things, not put them away.
Andrei and Kolya have woken. Andrei takes off his blanket, warm from his body, and wraps it around Marina so that she's tented from head to foot, with an open flap to gather the heat of the stove. Anna puts water to heat.
Tea, Marina. That'll make you feel better. Look in my boots, mumbles Marina from inside her blanket cave.
In your boots? All this has finally sent her crazy.
Your boots are on your feet, Marina.
Your feet are in them.
Not these. My other ones. She means her felt boots, says Kolya,
in the languid, unchildlike voice that makes Anna's hair crisp with fear.
They're in the kitchen.
They aren't really Marina's felt boots. They were Vera's. They were always too small for Anna, but they've been kept for years, carefully packed with newspaper and camphor balls. Who would ever get rid of a pair of felt boots? When the first snow came, her father had remembered them for Marina. To Anna's annoyance, they fitted Marina perfectly.
Yes, says Marina. In the kitchen. Look inside them, Anna.